You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here. Jamal Collier, our MLB.com Nationals reporter, as well as spring training rolls on for this Nats team. And we'll look at some different things. Matt Wieters coming along. We've seen some cuts in the last week as well, and some signings, a little bit of everything around this Nationals team. But let's start with action on the field as far as Grapefruit League action goes. Steven Strasburg was on the field pitching on Monday, looking pretty good. Five strikeouts over four innings. He did give up a couple of runs, but he sounds like he's right where he wants to be at this point in the spring.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an encouraging thing as well for Steven, because, you know, first of all, the biggest thing with him always is health. And can they keep, you know, can he stay healthy? Can he keep him healthy through, the entire season, the entire spring is kind of the question. But especially when you think about where Max Scherzer is right now, still with the question mark that kind of is his finger, if he's not going to be ready to go opening day, then Strasburg is kind of the guy that's going to be right in line, you know, behind him to take that spot. So he's still kind of working out the kinks of pitching out of the stretch kind of full time now. And, you know, just got to get more and more comfortable with that as he, you know, ditches the windup and does that, you know, with each and every start. But so far, so good. He says he's not losing any velocity. He's not really losing any command or any of his stuff and movement on his stuff so far, going full from the stretch. So, you know, he seems pretty happy with it and seems pretty committed to where he's going. So far, been pretty much encouraging signs for Steven here in the first couple of starts in spring training.
Obviously, that is a sizable adjustment, losing that windup, but it's pretty neat that he doesn't lose anything on the pitches. You mentioned Scherzer and a sim game on Sunday. He threw a couple of innings in that, and it sounds like he's starting to get to that point where he's on track, and we're heading towards him getting regular game action and eventually finding his way into this rotation. Whether or not it's on opening day, I guess that's yet to be determined.
Yeah, so that's really where we are, right in that kind of borderline here where we still got time, but there's also kind of slowly, you know, losing time here. So the thing for Max next step is going to be a minor league game where they can, again, kind of control things for him a little bit better and have him in an environment where they can manipulate it a little bit. And, you know, then after that, you would think the next step is kind of getting to Grapefruit League games. You talk about the start of the regular season for opening day. Yes, you know, the timeline is very kind of small here at this point. It's only about, you know, a little over three weeks, I think it is, left. But really, you don't need a fifth starter probably in that first 7 or 10 days with the off days kind of built into the schedule. So I think the thing that the Nats might be looking at for Max is to have him ready, maybe start the season necessarily on the DL, but maybe have him spend 10 days, have him spend a couple of days where you don't need that starter just yet and have him pitch maybe a week or so into the season. But again, they haven't started figuring that out just necessarily yet. But so far, so good. Max is starting to throw and build up his innings and his pitch count. With the still using the modified grip on the fastball, but is making some sort of progress right now.
Obviously, with the Matt Wieters signing late in the offseason, Jamal, the catcher position became interesting and a little too full, and it sounds like Derek Norris is on waivers. They put him on waivers over the weekend. It's a weird situation where they bring in a catcher and then it ends up being they can kind of get a better guy, and then Derek Norris is the odd man out. How do you see this playing out over the next week?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably it's somewhere a little sooner than that we're going to kind of figure out what Derek Norris' future is. If he is out by Wednesday for the Nats, they can kind of save, I believe they only have to pay him 1/16th of his salary, or 1/6th, I believe, of his salary, which comes up to about around $700,000 or so. So it could just be a huge saving for them. They just kind of end up outright cutting him. They haven't really had any success as far as trying a way to trade him so far. Just obviously teams knowing that they're going to have to unload him at some point, it doesn't really give them a whole lot of leverage. So, like you said, a weird situation that Derek has, you know, for all accounts kind of handled really well. And they've been really impressed, I guess, with just his professionalism and the fact that he really has, made the best of an awkward situation, to say the least. But I would guess that here, especially as we wind down in the spring training, you know, only one catcher can go at a time. So you got a guy like Matt Wieters, they've obviously got to get ready on kind of an accelerated pace. They still have to have Jose Lobaton get in there and get his reps. Pedro Severino is a guy who could help potentially at some point this season in the majors. So they still have to get these guys ready and get them innings and at bats as well and innings behind the plate and get them comfortable with the pitching staff. So I think at this point, it's just too many catchers to really go around. I think that's why Norris is future here would probably be settled, definitely not in the next couple of days, right after that, we'll see exactly where he lands.
It's an interesting case because he's an arbitration case that they only have to pay one-sixth of his salary. So how does that work, Jamal, when he eventually, and I'm sure he's going to sign with another team and it won't take a lot of time because here's a guy who has a proven track record that he can hit and play behind the plate. Will that team then end up paying the rest of what his arbitration salary was going to be?
It's a good question. I believe then at that point he just becomes an outright free agent.
Okay.
And at that point then somebody would have to sign him to just an entirely new deal, depending on what that would be. But I'm actually not I would think it's that because it's almost essentially if you're non-tendering the guy, but you had agreed to tender him and paid him a little bit. Not specific on that, but I'm almost sure that he then just becomes a free agent. They have to then sign him to a new contract.
It's just one of those cases that you really rarely see when a team's agreed to an arbitration deal and then lets the guy loose. So certainly something to keep an eye on, and we'll learn something about the way all this stuff works in Major League Baseball as this plays out. So that obviously brings us straight in to Matt Wieters, who is a little behind as far as getting ready, and you mentioned he needs to get the innings in and that sort of thing. Where is he right now? How does he feel, and is he going to be ready to go by opening day?
Yeah, I would think right now he's still on track for opening day, but it's still early. I mean, he's only he played on Sunday for the first time, played again on Monday, but he just kind of hasn't been out there a whole lot. Now, he's a guy who said he probably needs about 20, 30 at bats or so from each side, I believe it is, and trying to get him into games, and Dusty's also saying we can't play him for full games at this point. I mean, his body's kind of not ready and used to that either, so. It's going to be a weird kind of accelerated pace, for him. I think one of the things he said is nice is that as far as learning the pitching staff goes, the Nats have a pretty veteran staff that know exactly what they want to do or have an idea with how they want to attack hitters at the plate anyway. So it's not like he's, having to learn a staff and coach a bunch of young hitters through all games. These guys know how to work through a lineup two or three times. So he thinks that part will be a little bit more easy, and then he may kind of let the pitchers kind of call and rely on them a lot more early in the season before he truly gets comfortable. But, so far, like I said, at least the positive is that he's in the game and starting to kind of get his work in and get going. But you would think as far as everything goes that he should be ready for opening day at this point.
We talked about Coda Glover really before spring training even really got going and about the fact that he's a guy who has this powerful arm, upper 90s fastball, and really a guy the organization thought eventually had closer stuff. Now we've gotten a chance to see him throughout spring training, Jamal, and I guess none of that has changed, but how does he now fit into the conversation of a late inning role as opposed to the thought of him being good before he was actually out there doing it in Grapefruit League action?
Yeah, I mean, what they've seen in Grapefruit League action is nothing short of impressive. He's probably been, the single most impressive relief pitcher they've had so far. Just everything looks exactly like it did when he came up and started so hot to shoot up through the minors. And he's got the lights out slider, the fastball. He's got everything kind of working right now. And looks really good. There was a question mark there when he got hit at the end of the season, and it kind of revealed that he had torn his labrum in his hip. To say, okay, how much of this was hindering him, and that's why he got hit, or how much had people just kind of figured him out. And I think that, right now you can point and say, well, that hit probably was really bothering him. And that's really why he kind of struggled down the stretch last year. So, do I expect him to be named a closer at opening day at this point? That's probably still not, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think he's still kind of fighting to make the team in some ways. But I think also, he's a guy that if he keeps this up and it's healthy, that he's certain for the bullpen and going to play an important role still late in the innings for them. And the biggest thing, a lot of people have kind of said this as well, is that if they get to a point midseason where, they've got the question mark still, that closer isn't kind of solidified, that if he's a guy who, if he's pitching well and pitching like this, they may slide him into it, at some point in June or July. So again, getting ahead of ourselves at this point with him, but right now he looks very good and they're kind of really optimistic. That's exactly what he could be. And develop into here over the next couple of months and couple of years.
Yeah, 23 years old, you would think there's definitely some closing to see from him down the road at some point in his future. Speaking of young arms, Eric Fetty, another guy that's looked good. He's not a guy that's going to be on the roster, I would think, but the future, again, looking forward for an arm, Eric Fetty looks pretty good this spring.
He does. You know, once Giolito and Lopez kind of got traded, he kind of moved up the depth chart here a couple of rungs as well. So he's a guy who, like you said, probably not going to make the opening day roster. They're really not a spot for him. They want him to start. He's never pitched at AAA just yet. But, you know, he's a guy that if he probably starts the season somewhere at Syracuse and could potentially, if he pitches well, we may see him somewhere in midsummer or somewhere if there's an injury to kind of step in and fill a role and get some starts. But, yeah, very, very encouraging from what they've seen from him so far. And I think, like you said, it's a guy who, if he continues to progress and build, could be somebody who they think can be a rotation mainstay here going forward.
One more question for you, Jamal, and we're going to kind of hit the way back machine here. The Nationals have signed John Lannon to a minor league deal. Here's a guy who pitched 6 years for the Nationals from 2007 to 2012, and I think most people maybe have forgotten this guy threw opening day in 2009 and 2010. Hasn't pitched in the majors since 2014. He spent some time in the high minors, also some time in independent ball over the last couple of years. Obviously, he's trying to hang on, and a team that has a relationship with him in the Nationals is giving him a chance. Kind of a feel-good story, though.
Yeah, really interesting story to see exactly kind of can he revitalize his career and make a return here. You know, the reports is that potentially the Nats are going to try to reinvent him a little bit and make him a submariner. I don't know how exactly, you know, he may taste it at or what makes them think that's a good fit for him. But it's going to be interesting to see can he rebuild himself as a reliever and kind of make it back to, you know, proverbially where it all started with the Nats. But like you said, a guy who made two opening day starts with them and back when this was the Hunter Loss team and a new team, new franchise was, you know, one of their kind of premier pitchers, one of their better pitchers. So, really kind of a neat chance for a story. If he can make it, he's going to be in minor. He's in minor league camp, I should say, right now, and still has a ways to go, you know, if and when he ever pitches on a mound at Nats Park. But, you know, right, just a cool signing in general just to see, you know, what does he have left? And the organization, I'm sure, is you know, obviously familiar with him and sees the potential. He's still only late 31 or 32 years old, so. Not an old guy by any means, and it'll be fun to see exactly what becomes of this.
Yeah, we'll see. He's in, like you said, minor league camp. No invite to major league camp, but we'll see where this plays out down the road. Maybe the last chance for John Lannon to get back to the major leagues. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. New York Mets spring training continuing down in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Tim McMaster here, joined on the line by MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo. And Anthony, let's get right to it. Tim Tebow got a hit today. We'll cover other stuff as well, but I think last week on the podcast I said we wouldn't talk about Tebow again until he did something, and he has done that just 1 week later. So 1-for-3 in the game with a single. He also made a nice catch. Neat to see him doing well, but just kind of sum up his day for the Mets today.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd see him again either. Terry Collins said he kind of rethought the situation, and you know, the Mets need players with 11 of their guys gone to the WBC right now. And, you know, they've been borrowing guys from minor league camp with regularity. They made their first cuts over the weekend and had to borrow most of those guys right back just to fill out a roster in a Grapefruit League game. And Terry Collins said his line of thinking was, well, why bring an 18-year-old over when I could bring over a 29-year-old who really needs the at-bats against upper-level competition? So we see Tim Tebow, and we see him out in games, and he looked much the same, but he did get a hit. It was an opposite field single, which is something you always like to see from a hitter. I think it speaks to his improvement, that he's not just looking to pull everything. He's not just looking to hit everything over the fence. And, hey, you know, you have to start somewhere. And Tim Tebow's 1-for-10 on the spring now. It's not great. It's not where you want to be. But if he really does want to go down there to A-ball and have a good summer and get closer to his ultimate goal, you know, which is theoretically to play in the big leagues, you have to start somewhere. And for Tim Tebow, this was it. I think the most impressive thing I saw today was not the hit, but the sliding catch he made to rob Justin Bour of a single. It was a legitimately very good catch. It would be a highlight reel play for any player. And, of course, the fact that it was Tim Tebow makes it all the more interesting. Coming in, a difficult catch, kind of sliding, skidding down to get the ball. So it was a good day overall for Tim Tebow. The best one certainly he's had yet in the three games he's played in big league camp.
You mentioned the first round of cuts, and one of the guys involved in that was Dominic Smith, one of the club's top prospects, sent down to minor league camp. He didn't hit great in his time at big league camp, but I guess what he did show off is his ability to play first base. And you don't often think of, I mean, somebody wins the Gold Glove at every position, but we usually don't highlight first basemen for their defense. But Smith's a guy who can really flash the leather over there.
Yeah, and we saw it in big league camp. I was impressed. I'd never really seen Dom Smith play on a regular basis until this spring. Just saw him on a couple of events, Futures game here and there. But he looked good over there at first base. You saw the effect, certainly, of all that weight that he lost. I believe it was 24 pounds that Dominic Smith dropped over the offseason, cutting out fatty foods, working at the club's Barwis facility up in Michigan. So he came into camp in shape, lean, athletic, looking good. And you saw it certainly on the defensive side. Didn't have a great offensive camp. The Mets aren't worried about that because they've never really been worried about Dominic Smith's ability to hit a baseball. And this summer in Las Vegas in the Pacific Coast League, just a launching pad for hitters. I think everyone in the organization expects him to have a big, big offensive season and start to put up those power numbers the Mets have dreamt of from Dominic Smith when they drafted him in the first round. But defensively, he looked smooth. There were multiple plays this spring in limited time when he saved teammates of errors. One was a nice pick, I remember, on a low throw. One was a grab and tag the guys. He's coming down the line. Just very nice, smooth, athletic plays. And as long as he can get that bat into shape where it can be big league caliber and he can hold down the first baseman's position, it's gold glove potential with the glove.
Yeah, and the power numbers started to come a little bit last year. And like you said, when you're playing in Las Vegas, just about everybody puts up good numbers, and a guy with that potential should, and maybe we'll see him at some point during the 2017 season. So the Mets have some guys playing in the World Baseball Classic. There's good news and bad news from that. We'll start with the good, and that is Seth Lugo looking great for Puerto Rico, who is looking great as a team in the tournament so far, as they went actually 3-0 in pool play to advance out of their pool into the second round. But Lugo against a Venezuela team that is basically, when you look at the lineup, a Major League Baseball all-star team. He goes 5 1/3 scoreless innings. That's great to see for a guy who looked pretty good before he left for the WBC and Mets camp.
Yeah, Venezuela is absolutely stacked. And like you said, Seth Lugo did not allow a run in Grapefruit League play before he left the WBC. Had that great start against Venezuela. And that was kind of the deal for guys like Seth Lugo. And on the hitting side, TJ Rivera, Ty Kelly, Brandon Nimmo. The Mets had a bunch of their fringe roster guys who may or may not make the opening day team, playing the WBC. And part of the reasoning was, well, what's a better way to showcase someone? Is it in this atmosphere where, I mean, you've seen it on TV with these games, are some of them are sold out, huge atmospheres, just raucous fans, and against high-level competition, or one of these Grapefruit League games against, you know, the Marlins or the Astros, where you're facing minor leaguers, and just the intensity level, for obvious reasons, is not the same. I think the Mets see the WBC as a great opportunity, and when you get a guy like Seth Lugo, who is thriving there, it has to make you pause and say, well, hey, is this a guy we need on our roster? The Mets were talking at the beginning of camp, potentially having Seth Lugo start the season at AAA and stretch him out and have him be that sixth starter, so to speak, in case of an injury, or I should say when an injury comes, because it will at some point this summer. Now you hear Terry Collins talking about, well, maybe we need Seth Lugo in the bullpen. Maybe he's that bridge between the starting pitchers and those late inning relievers, the Jerry Blevins and Hansel Robles, Addison Reed. So Seth Lugo is making waves. And believe me, the Mets are paying attention to everything he's doing in the World Baseball Classic.
Now, the negative I mentioned is Nimmo, who you had mentioned, and he strains a hamstring playing for Italy. I don't think it's anything serious. Is he back with the Mets now because of the injury, or is he still with Italy?
He's on his way back, and the Mets team of training staff and doctors will check him out here. It does not sound like it's a major injury, but we're getting to the point in camp. We're in mid-March now, and any injury can disrupt the player's flow and what they're doing in their preparations for opening day. So conservatively with a hamstring, you would say maybe 2 weeks is what you need. And if that's the case, all of a sudden you're looking at the very end of March into the very beginning of April. And how is Brandon Nimmo going to win a spot on this team if he has not played a game in approximately 2-3 weeks from the time the Mets have to make that decision? It makes it very, very difficult and might open up a spot for another guy. The Mets still have to make a decision on Michael Conforto, if he's going to make the team in that bench outfield spot, or if not, maybe they just take an infielder like a TJ Rivera or a Matt Reynolds or a Ty Kelly who can play the outfield. Any number of ways the Mets can go, but standing here right now on March 13th with this injury fresh for Brandon Nimmo, it's suddenly very, very difficult to see him making the team, which is a shame because he had really made some strides and the Mets were impressed with some of the things he was doing this spring and also in the WBC.
How about Paul Sewald this spring, Anthony? He's been really good, and you have a story on the site about the fact, kind of the moment that it all clicked for him last year, and the reason you have pitching coaches, I guess, is to point stuff out. That's what happened with him a year ago in AAA, and now he's in the discussion to make this roster.
Yeah, actually, one of the stats guys on the Mets was talking to Paul Sewald and looking at his season, because he got off to a great start last year at AAA and then kind of fizzled in the middle of the summer, and they were looking at what he was doing, and his slider was by far his best pitch, and the Mets kind of came to him and said, well, you should throw this pitch more. So he started doing that and had some very good success, and you're seeing it now this spring. He's throwing the slider a lot. He's getting swings and misses with it. He's had some success. I believe he's given up, at the time of us recording this, one run in seven innings. So there's definitely a spot for him at the back of the bullpen if he continues to perform like this. And he's an interesting guy. He's a smart guy. He's very self-aware about his pitching and what he needs to do to succeed. And I think that's important when you don't have off-the-chart stuff. And he doesn't. He pitches 91, 92 with the fastball. But then you look at those strikeout numbers, even the Pacific Coast League, which is a, as I mentioned earlier, hitter-happy league, probably the most in the nation. Paul Sewald struck out 11 batters per nine innings with that 91, 92-mile-an-hour fastball and the slider. Essentially a two-pitch pitcher. So it tells you two things. It tells you, one, that despite the not having the upper-end velocity, the stuff is good. And it also tells you that he knows how to pitch. So not a roster lock by any means, but he's certainly put himself in the mix of this competition. There's two, maybe three spots available at the back end of the Mets bullpen. Josh Smoker has looked good this spring from the left side. Rafael Montero has looked better, and the Mets are talking about him as a potential bullpen candidate. There are a bunch of guys in the mix, and it could be an interesting race that goes right down to the very final days of camp.
It's amazing how simple the game of baseball can be at times. Hey, this is your best pitch. You should throw it more. Okay, and off we go. It is kind of amazing. All right, one last thing to touch on is Noah Syndergaard, because he's sick, I guess, but he also has a bobblehead. You can see video on Mets.com of him kind of checking out his bobblehead for the first time. He's as excited as Noah Syndergaard, I guess, gets about things like that. But he's sick as well. Is he going to be all right pulling through? What did you say it was exactly that's keeping him away?
It's bronchitis for Noah Syndergaard. And it's good for the Mets that he at least has a diagnosis, because he's been dealing with this sort of mystery ailment for a couple of weeks now. And Noah Syndergaard said today, actually, that it's been about a month and a half since he first started feeling under the weather. But the Mets do say it's bronchitis. They say he's pitched really most of this spring, or most of the Grapefruit League outings, with it. But he's on medication. He's working to get better. He's working to rest. The Mets actually sent him home from camp one day last week because he was feeling so ill. But he does say he's on the upswing now. He got a little fatigued during the fourth inning of today's start, gave up three runs. But it's early enough in camp that you would hope 2 weeks should be enough for Noah Syndergaard to knock this out of his system and be ready to go April 3rd, opening day against the Braves.
All right, and we will be ready to see that. Great stuff as always, Anthony. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Marlins spring training rolling along. Tim McMaster here, joined by our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Fusaro. And Joe, while the Marlins are playing baseball, obviously up and around Jupiter, Florida, there is baseball being played in Miami at Marlins Park. So obviously we'll get to the Marlins in this podcast, but I wanted to start with the World Baseball Classic action that's been going on in Miami, because I know you haven't been at the games, Joe, but you've been in that ballpark and you've covered this type of games. The Dominican Republic is there, Canada, the U.S., Colombia, and they've been sellouts and the crowds have been electric. For people that haven't been in that ballpark and have an idea, just kind of explain the atmosphere that can be at Marlins Park.
Yeah, it's a giant fiesta, you know, basically. It's music nonstop. It's, you know, before you even get into the ballpark, there are fans out there, not only just wearing the gear, face painting, you know, the colors of their flags of their countries, and, you know, playing drums and horns are blowing, and just a lot of dancing and partying. From what I understand, the other night, from someone who was at the USA against the DR, when Cruz hit the 3-run homer, in the promenade level of Marlins Park, they have the famous bobblehead museum. A friend of mine said that the Dominican fans actually did a dog pile right by there. You know, that's not crazy. You know, the fans are as much of a story, you know, at these events as the game itself. And clearly passion runs very high. And, you know, I talked to David Sampson the day after. I gave him a call, the Marlins president, and he was as happy as I've heard him in years. He said he watched the game with the commissioner that night, and they basically, Tim, in a nutshell, in terms of what the World Baseball Classic represents and what the league and what, you know, Miami was hoping to accomplish, and is just to really, you know, showcase baseball on a stage that, you know, we don't see every day, you know, at a big league ballpark. And that's, you know, to bring some flavor and some energy level that that rivals kind of a concert.
Yeah, it's been absolutely incredible down there. And of all the World Baseball Classics we've seen, I think those games down there, because of the ballpark and the way that obviously there's a roof on top, it's really been incredible noise. And I know on the broadcast for MLB.com, Marlon Anderson actually said it's the loudest ballpark he had ever been in at any point in his career. So certainly pretty cool.
And I also want to touch, I know a lot of mentioning the DR, and the credit to their fans, who many are, you know, live in South Florida or made the trip from the DR, obviously knowing that these games are being played there. If Venezuela was there or Puerto Rico, it would have rivaled it. It would have been very similar. So it's not just a DR Miami story. It's pretty much any of those teams from the Caribbean that make their way over and play in South Florida. And, you know, I've covered the Classic every year, except, you know, in South Florida as well. And it's a similar vibe and atmosphere, but this one was just kind of off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on to this Marlins team. And nothing super exciting going on for this team as spring training chugs along here, but some interesting stuff going on. One of those things is JT Realmuto getting his first chance at first base. And, Joe, it sounds like it's going to kind of work if he's going to be playing a little bit over at first base. He's picking it up quickly.
Yeah, and that's not surprising because JT is just an incredible athlete who happens to play catcher. He got drafted as a shortstop, although when they drafted him, they never intended for him to be an infielder. They even noted to him that they intended to immediately move him to catcher, which was important because as good an athlete as JT Realmuto is, the people down here know, but I'm not sure everyone's well aware, he had a scholarship opportunity for quarterback at Oklahoma State University, his favorite school growing up in Oklahoma. So, you know, this kid, pretty much anything on a baseball field I think he can do. He's a kid who, when he was in high school, he played shortstop and see the plays around this team, you know, when they were on their way going towards the state championship one year. So playing from first base, that's going well. But let's keep in mind it's going to kind of be like Buster Posey does it in San Francisco. It's not going to be an everyday thing in terms of left-handed pitchers on the mound, just in four sits, and JT Realmuto goes and plays first base. I would anticipate, you know, everything going well, you know, 15 to 20 starts over there. But the key is keep his bat in the lineup and try to alleviate a little bit of the wear and tear of you know, being in a crouch and taking all the abuse you do catching in the big leagues.
Yeah, keep him fresh because certainly he's a guy who can contribute at the plate as well. And if he can stay a little fresher throughout the season, he'll only be that much better in that regard. Talking about the bullpen, and there's new pieces, obviously, this season with Ziegler and Tozawa being there. And so far, both those guys, Joe, have been pretty impressive.
Yeah, let's start with Tozawa. He has like 3 or 4 innings. You know, he's been out there in the games, and, you know, he's getting that fourth ball going, a huge pitch for him. And I anticipate him, you know, fitting into the seventh and eighth inning role, you know, probably getting some left-handers, assignments because the Marlins are not really anticipating carrying the three left-handers or in terms of the traditional specialist. So with any right-handers with the ability to get lefties out. So, he's been out there and eager to get in the game. The other day was really, really effective against the Astros. And, he, a team that he has seen from the, playing in the, when he was over, in Boston. And one of his teammates, Josh Reddick, he got to face him. But Ziegler is a little more interesting, Tim, because he's kind of been in hiding. He's 37 years old. He's that submarine, sinking ball style of guy. He doesn't need a lot of innings. And they kind of mapped out, even when they signed him, that we weren't going to see him really in a great league game. So if you kind of looked at his line, you'd see one inning and one strikeout, and it was a clean inning, and you wonder what's going on. He's been facing minor leaguers in the backfield. So that's what was going on. But when he got out there for the first time against the Cardinals, very effective. And again, a guy who lives by deception and is not, going to overdo it in great league games.
Don Mattingly has some decisions to make, but they don't seem like hard ones, Joe, when you talk about the starting rotation. It seems to make a lot of sense how it's going to pan out, especially with Jeff Locke seemingly not going to be ready for opening day. But Mattingly, at this point, not committing to anything as far as that rotation goes.
It kind of raises some questions if everyone's completely healthy. We haven't seen in great league games Straley and Connolly for a while, but that kind of panned out because their scheduled date of pitch was on their off day a week ago, and they also, the time before, were piggybacking off each other, and they faced the Mets at St. Lucie in early, it was March 2nd or 3rd, and they were kind of lined up again to face the Mets in Port St. Lucie, and the Marlins don't want either one of them to see the Mets. I mean, they're going to see them before the season starts. So their work has been kind of going on in the backfield. But barring anything unforeseen health-wise, I think we kind of know how it's going to fall. This is kind of the order I think it will go. Because I think he'll try to break up the lefties. I think it would go Volquez, who's pitching for the Dominican Republic right now in the Classic. Followed by William Shin, and then probably Tom Kohler, a veteran guy in this rotation, and Connolly and Straley, and that's what just separates lefties, Shin and Connolly, mixes them in with the right-handers.
As for Locke, it's left biceps tendonitis. Where is he at right now? I know it's unlikely he'll be ready to go for opening day, but what is his current status?
It's throwing progression right now, a lot of that boring flat ground stuff, one day on, one day off, that type of thing. Hasn't really advanced much. Not paying a ton of attention to him because I kind of anticipate that's where he's going to, he'll be starting five or off the mound or seeing some type of simulated game action by the time we break camp in a few weeks. But, the key with the Marlins and Jeff Locke is this guy is very valuable to them because he can start or relieve and, probably not, I noted that he's a holistic specialist. And even if he opened in the pen, which was probably the likely scenario, it wouldn't have been the go of the seventh inning against Bryce Harper. It would have probably been a long relief type of situation. So the Marlins need him. They don't have a ton of starting pitching depth. And, so they rather, if they miss the first two, three weeks of April, they'll trade that off for a healthy five months to kind of wrap it up. So, again, they're confident it's not a serious thing. There's inflammation. But as you know, whenever there's setbacks to pitching in spring training, if it knocks you a week, 2 weeks, you're pretty much in danger of missing opening day. So, that's where Locke stands right now.
One more thing for you, Joe. Friday was the first cuts of the spring. Any surprises in that mix of the guys that went back to the minor league camp?
No, not really. I mean, probably the guy most of knows was Jake Esch. Right-hander who saw some big league time, made like three starts in September, that he goes down to New Orleans, and starts there. And that was going to happen, but sometimes, you get guys down there just to get their work in because, they're clearly at that stage. They weren't going to make the team. I'm sure from his standpoint, you would like to be, in the mix a little bit more to compete for a roster spot, but you never know. Injuries do pop up, and if you're under Tom Mattingly's eye, you'll that only helps your cause. But he would be the closest. But everything else is kind of anticipated.
Great stuff, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fusaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster along with MLB.com Braves reporter Mark Bowman as we continue to cover this Braves team throughout spring training and into the season here on the podcast. Mark, first of all, get some guys back in camp today. It is Wednesday afternoon as we record this podcast, and Freddie Freeman is back after Canada was eliminated from the World Baseball Classic. Julio Teheran also back, but he won't play until the weekend, I guess. But were those guys able to talk at all? Have you heard them talk at all about the experience of the World Baseball Classic?
Freddie Freeman said it was one of the coolest experiences he's had in baseball. He compared it, to the experiences he had in the playoffs. And, he said if given a chance, he certainly would do it again. And while he understands the concerns teams may have with the pitchers, from a position player standpoint, this makes perfect sense because you're given a chance to go be in a truly competitive atmosphere where, not only are you trying to best represent your country or your team, you've got the guys out there on the mound who are trying to win a game like they would in the regular season. And you don't get that in spring training. You may have a pitcher working on things. He talked about how, look, I haven't seen 95, 96 here in spring training. Probably wouldn't have. Whereas he goes down there and, he basically was in an atmosphere similar to what he would experience during the regular season. And so he hopes that this does better prepare him for, to maybe avoid that slow start he had last year. But he had nothing but great things to say about the Classic. And obviously he had a chance to compete against Julio. And Julio's first pitch to him was up and in, so they both got a chuckle out of that. Freeman got a single in that first at bat, and then he said he would have had another one, but Columbia had 14 right fielders. So, while he supports the World Baseball Classic, that was another shot against the shift.
All right, you have a story on Braves.com right now, Mark, about the projected lineup for the Braves at this point in the spring, and it looks just like kind of what we saw as a projected lineup over the winter, and not a lot has changed. But one thing that was a little different was that Eric O'Flaherty has really pitched himself into the conversation as far as being a part of that bullpen. What has stood out the most to you about O'Flaherty?
I guess you have to start with health. I mean, you go back to 2010 to 2012, the only reliever and with a better ERA than O'Flaherty. And during that span was Frank Kimbrell, his teammate, Braves teammate there. So when he came to camp, he admits, he's like, look, I thought it was a long shot too. He didn't know exactly how well he was going to throw. But from the first appearance he had this year, Tyler Flowers was catching him. He was talking about how much the ball was sinking. And that was the O'Flaherty of old. He said, okay, well, that was that day. And then, the next day there was more of the same. The next game there was more. He's still going to have to pitch well over the final 2 weeks, but if this team broke right now, went north today, Eric O'Flaherty would be part of that roster. It's just that he's regained that sinker that he had back during his most dominant days, the sinker he wasn't able to throw once he had Tommy John surgery in 2013 and then, 14, 15, 16 were all a struggle. He's able to get extension. And it's nice, we kind of talk. It makes for good stories here during spring training. You kind of laugh, and you're always like, when you get to June, you say, oh, man, that was a big story. And you're talking about the eighth man in the bullpen or seventh man in the bullpen, whatever. While O'Flaherty might be getting that last spot, if he pitches like he has here the last couple of weeks, he's certainly more than a seventh or eighth guy. And if everyone else continues to live up to expectations, the Braves are going to have that depth in the bullpen. That they've been seeking, not only to, while they upgraded their rotation, they realize that they've got Jaime Garcia with some injury concerns, and Bartolo Colon and R.A. Dickey might provide some more certainty than the young pitchers they had, and maybe more consistency than they got from the young pitchers. But at the same time, hey, look, these guys are in their 40s. So you can't treat them like young thoroughbreds.
O'Flaherty, a perfect example of why teams bring in a whole bunch of relievers in the spring and get them out there and see what's going to happen, because you never do know. So much changes from year to year as far as bullpen arms go, guys having great years followed up by disappointing years. You got to have numbers, and then guys like O'Flaherty step up, have a great spring, and can really be a neat story. You also have a story about Foltynewicz and kind of his, I guess, a mental state as far as pitching and pitching in games. And I think the quote from him was, I don't want to be a jerk, but there's a negative attitude in a sense that you need on the mound when facing major league hitters in order to get them out.
Exactly. You know, it's basically, he kind of, one interesting part of that quote was he kind of said that he admits that he did lose his aggression at times on the mound. You know, all of a sudden, whether that was, you know, not necessarily always facing a former teammate, but maybe allowing him to, himself to be in awe of the situation, or maybe, hey, look, you know, maybe doubting whether he truly belonged. And look, this guy does have the stuff to be a frontline pitcher. And you saw it, you know, occasionally last year. You just didn't see that. He wasn't able to put away hitters in certain, you know, certain at bats, or, you know, kill a potentially damaging situation. You know, and I think he's saying, hey, look, I needed a little bit of an attitude change there and be more aggressive. But at the same time, I've got to control my emotions, because his emotions did get the best of him last year at times, where he would shake his head at an umpire, you know, allow a, yeah, whether it was a defensive miscue or just some bad luck, allow that to affect his next pitch or the way he attacked the next batter. And he realizes, hey, look, while I've got to be more aggressive, I've also got to control my emotions. And I think that's, you know, he's still got some work to do. You know, even on Saturday when he said that, you know, the innings he had thrown right before that against the Marlins, there was an occasion or two where, you know, close pitch, you know, just off the plate, he kind of kicked the dirt or swiped his glove and, you know, made it clear he didn't agree. You got to wipe that part out of your game. While you're, you know, so the umpires are human too, you know. They see that, and they're going to, you don't get the benefit of the doubt, and you don't want to do that as a young pitcher.
Yeah, that's not going to help you get the next call, certainly. Aaron Blair is a pitcher, Mark, who's kind of proven himself at the minor league level, obviously, and pitched his way up and got into the point where he's on the cusp of the major leagues. But he's having a tough spring, and at the major league level, he's yet to really show it consistently. What is wrong there that he's able to get it done down in the minors, and he hasn't yet been able to translate that into major league success?
Well, you know, you get away with stuff there at the minor league level, and he's got the decent fastball. He's able to spot it, you know, well enough there, and the changeup, fastball changeup works there. If you don't have that out, that third pitch at the big league level, it's not going to work. And that's, you know, basically what he was working with last year was a fastball, a changeup, and a spinner. You know, he basically, you know, a ball just, you know, you really didn't want to call it a curveball or a slider. And now, you know, this. He's got a little bit more break to what he is calling a slider right now. It's not that hard slider. It's not the dominant, you know, one that you want to wow about or anything like that. But at the same time, it's something else to keep hitters off balance. Maybe to get some swings and misses in some situations, or some ground balls, get some guys to hit the ball into the ground. I think that is going to be, you know, the key that when he comes back up from the big leagues this year at some point, and he will, he'll be needed. He's probably going to be the first guy called up, you know, if the situation arises when they need to fill a spot in that rotation, he'll be there. But at the same time, it remains to be seen exactly how effective he can be, you know, with this weapon. But hey, look, at least he's going into battle with something that he did not have last year. And he's a little bit more confident. He talked yesterday about how he was, you know, he left spring training last year saying, hey, look, I'm ready for the big leagues. Well, he was humbled last year. And that humbling experience, you know, it can go one of two ways. Either you allow yourself to, you know, be defeated by it, or you allow it to make yourself better. Now, you know, I think he kind of understands that, hey, look, I've got to go back down to the minor leagues and improve myself again. And you know, maybe more appropriately, you better prepare yourself, because you will be needed.
Yeah, and the full line from Tuesday's start, really not completely telling. Four innings, six hits, three runs. But all those, most of that damage in one inning. Otherwise, he was pretty good in that one. He struck out three
the way. Yeah, I think it was, you know, four of those hits were within a span of five batters there in the second inning.
Right. So one other thing that came out of Tuesday, Micah Johnson It looks like kind of escaped what could have been a serious injury. Makes a diving grab, but kind of an awkward landing. Is he going to miss a little time? It seems like, sounds like for the most part, he'll be okay.
In my in that first sentence, for a reason, you know, and it's something that you have to use in this business. I said seemingly avoided a significant injury, and we don't know if it's significant or not. But he is going to undergo more evaluation. That while the X-ray was clean, did not show a fracture, he's going to undergo an MRI. That, you know, we'll see if there is something there, because you know, he still was pretty sore this morning. There was some swelling. So while it looked good yesterday and they were optimistic, I kind of sensed a different tone today. So we'll see exactly what the results were. He wasn't going to make the opening day roster, and he needs time to learn how to play the outfield. But at the same time, they've already lost Dustin Peterson. So now all of a sudden, you take out Dustin Peterson's out until May. You've got, you know, now Johnson's out. If you need to call somebody up as an outfielder up from the minor leagues, you know, they're depth. They were already very thin there at the game, spring training. They're going to be even more thin, you know, here for, you know, at least until Dustin Peterson's ready. And we don't know exactly how long Micah Johnson will be sidelined with this injury.
So fingers crossed as far as Johnson goes. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. Thanks so much, Mark. I'm Tim McMaster along with Mark Bowman. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster and MLB.com Phillies reporter Todd Zielecki here on the Extras podcast, our Phillies edition, as spring training rolls on. And the Phillies making a transaction this week, Todd. They trade for some bullpen depth. And it's some really interesting bullpen depth. People that have followed Major League Baseball as a whole and maybe the world outside of the Phillies have heard the name of Pat Venditti because he's an ambidextrous reliever, which is fascinating. He can throw with either arm, and now he's a member of the Phillies organization as they traded for him. He was actually pitching in the World Baseball Classic for Italy as well. Is this guy going to make the opening day roster, or is he a guy who will end up starting the year in the minors and could help the team at some point in the bullpen?
You know, I guess if I had to think about, you know, the best odds, I guess you could say, I think he's probably more likely to start the season in the minor leagues and help the team at some point. Now, that said, Phillies GM Matt Klentak the other day, after they made that trade, said that he is going to be competing for a job in the Phillies bullpen, and certainly – they need left-handed arms, and he can throw right-handed, but he can also throw left-handed. So that works in his favor. I wrote a little bit about the roster situation last week. You know, they've got five bullpen jobs locked up. All five of those guys are right-handers. That means they've got two spots open. There's a couple lefties on the 40-man roster that have a shot, Adam Morgan and Joely Rodriguez. And then there's two other lefty non-roster invitees in camp, Sean Burnett and Cesar Ramos. So there's four lefties kind of competing for jobs right now. And then and this is then Venditti, he will then go into that mix. Now, I don't know what his chances are. One thing I wrote about last week when I mentioned the roster situation is they're at the 40 men, obviously, but they don't have too much flexibility because they put 11 prospects on the 40 man last November. So I would say it would be a huge stunner if they picked any more than two non-roster invitees to make the 40-man roster, just because they value a lot of the players they have on the 40-man right now. So the fact that he's not on the 40-man, I think, works against him. But if he pitches well enough, he could be one of those one or two guys that make it.
Certainly a tricky situation with that roster with the young talent, and they had to protect them for the Rule 5 draft back in December, and they certainly did that. Other transactions are your normal cuts here, and on Tuesday morning, Mark Appel was optioned down to the AAA roster in spring training. Appel's a guy, obviously, it's been spoken a lot about, was the number one overall pick years back with the Houston Astros after being suspected to be a number one pick the year before that. He went back into the draft. The Astros took him number one. He handed over to the Phillies in a trade. When you look at Appel, he's a guy that when he was drafted, people expected by this point he would be a fixture in a major league rotation. Is he on track to still someday get there?
I think he's got a shot, but what's interesting now is that now that he's in minor league camp, you look at the rest of the starters in the organization, you know, but the Phillies' top five starters, big league starters, are set, and that is Jeremy Hellickson, Jared Eichhoff, Quay Buchholz, Vince Velasquez, Aaron Nola. So then you start thinking about who else is going to be in AAA. Well, well, some of their top prospects, I guess they're not technically prospects, Jake Thompson, Zach Eflin, are kind of the top two guys in that AAA rotation. And then you go with Ben Lively, who was the minor league pitcher of the year last year. You go with Nick Pivetta, who's the number 12 prospect in the organization. Ricardo Pinto pitched pretty well. He's a top 30 prospect for the Phillies. And then you go, okay, Mark Appel, now where does he fit into there? It's interesting. If Zach Eflin starts the season in the DL, which I think is a possibility, then Mark Appel, you know, certainly is going to be in the AAA rotation. He might be anyway. But the point I'm trying to make is they have a lot of depth right now, and it's not as simple as it was even last spring where it's like, well, if Mark Appel pitches great, he'll be up here by May. It is, you know, hey, if Mark Appel pitches great, you know, maybe he'll be up here if the other guys in the big league rotation aren't pitching well. Maybe he'll be up here if Eflin and Thompson and Pivetta and Lively and Pinto and Alec Asher, you know, haven't been more deserving of a spot. So his path to the big leagues with the Phillies is a lot trickier now than it has ever been, because Phillies' depth is so much better than it's ever been.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys in between him and a major league roster spot for sure. Right. Sticking with the young player theme, Nick Williams showing some flashes on Monday, hit his first home run. Made a great catch as well, and he's a guy that we talked a bit about, I think, last week, just because of his changed approach with the new hitting coach with the Phillies, and it seems to continue to pay off. First, it was paying off in BP and stuff like that, and now we're starting to see it in the games, Todd.
It is, yeah. He's actually had a really nice spring. I think he's hitting around 365, 368, OPS around 950, 960. Really been impressive so far, and you know, hey, it's spring. I always say this, you know, it's spring training, so it doesn't really mean much once the season starts, but it certainly beats the alternative. You know, Nick Williams hitting 360 to 950 OPS sure beats Nick Williams hitting 100 with the 260 OPS at this point, and the fact that he's looked so good at the plate, he's super confident right now. You can tell he's really optimistic about his chances this year. He's really got a good perspective on his struggles last season. And I also like the fact that he really seems to have taken to the instruction he's gotten, the additional instruction he's gotten this spring from new Phillies hitting coach Matt Stairs. He really seemed kind of excited about what he's been doing working on this spring. You know, I think the quote when we last talked about him was, he's like, I don't even know how I got hits before with my previous swing. So, and you know, hitting is so much of it is confidence, and he's got a lot of it right now. Certainly he's got a lot of talent, which is why he was a top 100 prospect last year. He's really kind of he was never off the radar, but he was a top 100 prospect that last year at this time. He's not a top 100 prospect anymore because he struggled last year in AAA. But I think a lot of people internally in the organization are kind of like, all right, this is the Nick Williams we expected. Let's see what he does the first couple months in Lehigh Valley. If he's tearing the cover off the ball, you know, come late July, if the Phillies trade Saunders or Howie Kendrick, I think the initial thought was it's absolutely going to be Roman Quinn. That's going to be promoted to take one of their spots. But, hey, maybe it's Nick Williams. If Nick Williams is doing what he's supposed to be doing, maybe they slide him up there instead.
Yeah, because certainly you'd like to think that in a year or 2 years, those two guys will be mainstays in that outfield for the Phillies. You mentioned the little things he's working on. Spring training is all about working on the little things. And I guess for Vince Velasquez, it's not about the pitching right now, but he's also focusing on keeping runners held on base. What is he doing to do that?
Yeah, that was kind of a fun conversation we had the other day in Dunedin. A lot of these pitchers, sometimes they just forget about the base runners, and the base runners take really good leads. They get good secondary leads. Then they go from first to third on a single, and maybe they shouldn't have, or they steal a base that maybe they shouldn't have been able to steal because the catcher has no shot to throw them out. So Pete McCann and Bob McCourt have been really hammering these guys on holding the ball, changing the amount of time you hold the ball to kind of disrupt the hitter, the hitter's timing and the base runner's timing. And he really worked on that the other day in Dunedin. In fact, it worked so well, he actually came in the dugout at one point and told Pete McCann, he's like, wow, you know, this really does work. I can't believe it. It was kind of almost like an aha moment for Vince Velasquez. And that was very encouraging for the Phillies. You know, he had Kevin Pillar was on first base in the bottom of the third or fourth inning. He tried to steal, but because Vince kind of held the ball and kept him a little bit flat-footed, Andrew Knapp was the catcher, threw him up by several feet. It wasn't even close. And maybe last year at this time, Pilar steals that base rather easily because, you know, Velasquez had become too too predictable in terms of, all right, this is how it goes. He gets the ball, goes to the stretch, 1-2, throws. Now he's maybe going 1-2-3. Maybe he's going 1. Maybe he's going 1-2-3-4 and then throwing. You know, you change your timing there a little bit, and it can really do wonders for you in terms of keeping the base running game in check.
One of the cool things about the World Baseball Classic is getting to see some young players play on kind of the big stage in spotlight moments. And as far as the Phillies go, Jorge Alfaro, there hasn't been many bigger moments in this year's World Baseball Classic than his game-tying home run in the bottom of the eighth inning against the Dominican Republic. His team ended up losing that game, but a great moment and an electric atmosphere. That's a cool thing to see because it's a big moment, and you see that a guy that's young and in your system has the ability to come through in a spot like that.
It is, and especially for a guy like him. And not to, like, kind of, degrade any other prospects that are in any other system that might be playing in the World Baseball Classic, but Jorge Alfaro is one of the top 100 prospects in baseball. He's the top three prospect in the organization, and they have super high expectations on him. You talk to any scout, and they'll say that this guy has plus power and a plus arm. So he has the potential to be a really power-hitting catcher that nobody wants to run on. And so to see him step up in that situation, I think it's going to help his confidence because he knows he can kind of exceed in those, perform in those situations. And, I think it's going to help. He's going to start the season in AAA. He's going to be the everyday catcher in AAA. And they're hoping that he can maybe put a little bit more contact on the ball, you know, kind of iron some things out offensively, improve his game calling behind the plate, and just, all the other things that come with playing catcher. And if he can do those things, he's going to put some heat on Cameron Rupp, and that's going to be another fun kind of competition to watch this year. Can Cameron Rupp kind of keep doing what he was doing last year? He was fourth among all major league catchers in slugging percentage, seventh in OPS. Will Jorge Alfaro be able to unseat him in that job?
Great stuff, and it's certainly going to be fun to watch because Alfaro is a guy they traded for with certainly high expectations, and he's showing that on the international level, at least, before he gets to the major leagues. All right, this has been MLB.com Extras. Our Phillies edition. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.